Started. First agenda item of the morning. Reports. I'll give a brief overview of our executive committee meeting, November 12th. Behind tab number one, document number 11, is the executive committee report. I'll touch on some or highlight some of the items. Number one, obviously the 2010 priorities is something we've already dealt with. Number two, impacts and other fisheries policy. There are two enclosures in this document number 11, enclosure two and enclosure three. Two very different takes on this policy. The executive committee went back and forth reviewing both policies and essentially determined that we shouldn't have a policy on this issue at all, and we should just leave it up to using Magnuson as our guiding principles on this issue. We discussed timeline and actions for whiting. Just to make clear that there's to the executive committee and now to the council, there's a data poor work group meeting this December. As you voted on Tuesday to undertake whiting in your priorities, we will work on the ACLAM, and I believe, I'm sorry, I can't remember whether we put limited access in or not. We didn't. Okay. So ACLs and AMs, and then when we get to December, we'll plug in the new science that comes out of data poor. We talked briefly about streaming the council meetings, audio, video, on the internet. We deferred that discussion until next executive committee meeting. We asked Paul Howard and staff to do a little more digging and research with the councils that are currently doing it. I know the Mid-Atlantic started it a meeting or two ago. We discussed the council's motion and NRCC discussion concerning the council's interaction with the SSC. Paul stated that the SSC is looking in scheduling a two-day meeting and having agendas done several months in advance. Adding SSC into this process must be very structured so that the SSC can allow for sufficient time to do its work. Staff gets best available science together, and committees would like to see this work before it gets to the SSC. If time permits, this can happen. However, there is seldom time to schedule a committee meeting and bring information from the PDT to the committee and then to the SSC. It says here, Dr. Pierce asks that when additional expertise is brought into SSC deliberations on an ad hoc basis, that the XCOM approve such a request. The executive committee agreed, and we're going to be bringing forward this change to the council. Currently in the SOPs, in order to add a new permanent member to the SSC, the executive committee is involved. However, in the SOPs, it also says if the SSC wants to add an ad hoc expert for a specific issue, all they need to do is ask the executive director or notify the executive director and get his approval. The executive committee is bringing forward a request to change SOPs such that even bringing in an ad hoc expert for a particular issue would require approval of the executive committee in whole as opposed to the executive director. We discussed TMGC intercessional in regards to setting of ABCs by the SSC. We reviewed the terms of reference for an intersessional meeting and recommended that this meeting be a video conference if possible and not a face-to-face meeting. If you look at enclosure three, those are the terms of reference that we reviewed. Lastly, we approved herring and recreational fishing advisory panel members. Mr. Robert Westcott was approved to serve on the herring AP. And Richard Bellavance, Peter Gaughan, Emily Litzinger, and Captain Patrick Parquette will serve on the RAP. On the issue on the change to the SOPs and the SSC, we'll bring that in February to the council for approval. Any questions or comments on the executive committee report? Maggie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, my question is about, I probably should have asked this when you discussed your work plan, priorities work plan. But the council did decide that you were not going to do anything on Whiting except for the ACLs and the AMs. And when the Whiting committee last met, they passed a motion charging the advisory panel to come up with a some recommendations on moratorium, limited entry for the fishery. So my question is, can that continue? Can the council charge the Whiting advisory panel to work on that, even though you're not planning on including that type of program in any action in any during this coming year?
Well, the hope was that we'd get all the ACL and AM work done in Whiting, then wait for the numbers from the data pool. But after we got all the numbers and all the work done for the ACL AM, then that staff person would assist in interspecies. That was my plan. So now it becomes a priority. Do you want additional staff to help out the interspecies workload, or do you want the extra staff to do what you just mentioned? So,
could I ask one more question? Another issue that was identified as an important issue in the Whiting by the Whiting Committee and advisors was a VMS requirement for the Whiting fishery, because one of the reasons why the data is poor in the Whiting fishery is that it's hard to attribute which area the fish came from. So I was wondering if in this action to do the ACLs and AMs, if there could be some consideration of a VMS requirement for the Whiting fishery in the hopes of improving the data on Whiting in the future.
My thought on that is that you could look at a VMS unit as as a component of creating an ACL and an AM. That could be part of the design. You could make the argument that it's necessary for that.
And if I could ask one more question on the same issue. In 2005, the council's ad hoc bycatch committee reviewed some observer data from the Whiting fishery, and there were some incidences of very high haddock bycatch in that fishery in the cultivator region. Is that something that will be looked at in the same action?
It was my hope in the proposal that we brought to the council for interspecies was looking at catch monitoring. It was my hope that we would have that type of a discussion across all the plans, so that we have a requirement as we touch each plan or renew each plan to update our understanding of bycatch plan by plan. I don't know where that stands at this point, although it's one of the requirements of Magnuson is to look at and minimize bycatch. So, it's not explicitly part of the charge to the committee, but at the same time, it's one of the responsibilities of the council and by extension the committee.
Thank you.
Anything further on the executive committee report? Okay. Executive Director.
Two quick things, Mr. Chairman. In terms of budget, recent communications with National Marine Fisheries Service is that the continuing resolution continues. But Congress is expected to pass a budget before they go on recess for the holidays. So that's good news. In case it doesn't happen, NMSA is prepared to give us a quarter of our budget, allocate that to us at the beginning of the year in January. Second thing is that our SSC is meeting December 8th and 9th, a two-day meeting, and they're going to be looking at developing an annual schedule with our staff when looking ahead with priorities and what type of actions they are expected to review, peer review, look at ABCs, et cetera. So that'll be December 8th and 9th. And so during that period, they were also going to talk about how they can best, get all their work done by scheduling a year in advance.
Questions for Paul? David?
Paul, one of the other SSC chairs I met in another meeting stated they were going to have a meeting of the SSCs. Has that occurred yet?
Yes, it was last week from Monday to Friday.
And, do you know if they reached any conclusions on some kind of standardized SSC policy? Or
actually, both Rick and Chris had attended, so if we have time, maybe at the end of reports or now, whatever the chair wishes, they could maybe give a little update.
Okay, I'd like to know if any consensus was reached on how to deal with SSC matters. Rick or Chris? Rick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did attend the meeting last week. It was really an excellent dialogue. There are a lot of questions, I think, that the SSCs around the country have, particularly about how the councils and SSCs might interact on the question of risk. That's a frontier, I think, for many of us. The SSCs around the country are at different levels of, they have different operating histories. They're evolved at different points. Obviously, the North Pacific has been at it for a very long time, and the practices around the country, not unlike the differences in the regional councils, are quite diverse. But there was not a policy initiative that came out of the meeting. There was a lot of dialogue, but I don't think there were any what I would consider to be policy initiatives that came out of that meeting.
So the SSCs are still going to operate independently based on their own regional preferences? Was that the outcome?
Dave, I think that's fair to say. There were a lot of discussions about the NS1 guidelines. A lot of this centered on, again, on the factors related to NS1. There were also discussions about the proposed rule on NS2, and so we had updates on that. Rick Mathot was there from the service and spoke quite a bit about both NS2 and NS1, but the NS1 guidelines are things that the SSCs are still working through and trying to determine how to apply some of those guidelines. So a lot of the discussion was focused on those particular details, but again, I don't think there's a consensus in terms of how those applications are going to be made around the country. But the dialogue itself was quite constructive, I thought, and there is a lot of difference in how the SSCs operate, as you know, so it was a good meeting.
Any other questions for Paul? Okay, I'll turn it over to Pat Kirkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Effective tomorrow, we've implemented a trawl gear restriction in the western U.S. Canada area for any northeast multi-species days at sea vessel fishing any part of a trip with trawl gear in that area south of 4140 north latitude. They'll have to fish using either a haddock separator trawl or a rule trawl. Vessels fishing in the western area north of the line may continue to use other trawl gear. The actions being taken to slow the catch of yellowtail flounder and prevent a premature closure of the eastern U.S. Canada area while still allowing access to cod and haddock stocks. For additional details, you can see our website. There are possession limit details and other things that are available there. For the interim rule, an extension to the interim rule was published in the Federal Register on October 27th to extend the effectiveness of the measures through the end of the fishing year. There were no changes to the management measures made. The comment period on the extension will end on November 27th. Amendment 16 for ground fish. On October 23rd, the notice of availability for the amendment to the multi-species plan was published in the Federal Register to solicit comments. The comment period on the notice of availability closes December 22nd. On October 30th, a notice of availability for the environmental impact statement prepared for Amendment 16 published in the Federal Register. Let's see. On October 30th, we sent a letter to all limited access multi-species permit holders informing vessels that had not signed on to a sector roster by September 1 of an additional opportunity to join the sector for fishing year 2010. Should the proposed Amendment 16 sectors agree to open their rosters, the new deadline to join is the 20th, tomorrow. On November 2nd, a final rule to require midwater trawl herring vessels fishing in closed area 1 to have 100% observer coverage and to prohibit slip nets becomes effective. The rule was requested by the Council at the April meeting in response to an analysis of observer data on groundfish bycatch by midwater trawlers in closed area 1 and includes exemptions from the prohibition on releasing a net unobserved for safety concerns, mechanical failure, or if his spiny dogfish clogged the fish pump. Let's see. An additional measure for a signed affidavit if a net is released requires approval under the Paperwork Reduction Act and will be implemented at a later date. Days at Sea leasing program for this year from May 1st through November 12th. Total leases processed, 580. Total leases approved, 549. Number of distinct permits, 601. Total number of days at sea leased, 11,807.46. Average cost per days at sea leased, $442.03. We published a proposed rule in the Federal Register on October 26th that would allow research projects funded through the Monkfish RSA to carry over unused Monkfish RSA days at sea into the following fishing year. The proposed action would not limit the number of RSA days at sea that could be carried over. The comment period closes November 25th. We published proposed 2010 summer flounder, scup, and black sea bass specifications in the Federal Register on November 4th. The comment period on those closes today, November 19th. We published 2010 Atlantic mackerel, squid, and butterfish specifications on November 12th, and the comment period on those closes on December 14th. On October 6th, we approved Amendment 10 to the Atlantic mackerel, squid, and butterfish FMP. With all the management measures proposed by the Council approved, a proposed rule for Amendment 10 published on September 3rd, and the comment period on that closed on October 19th. We hope to publish the final rule implementing Amendment 10 soon. We published a proposed rule on October 26th that would authorize the agency to issue an LOA to eligible vessels that would be temporarily in possession of restricted species for the purpose of collecting catch data. It's called a temporary possession LOA. Currently, federally permitted fishing vessels are required to obtain an exempted fishing permit for such activities. The comment period on that closes on November 25th. This temporary LOA would allow researchers and NIMS to forego the full EFP process. On October 6th, we published a determination that listing Atlantic wolffish under the Endangered Species Act is not warranted. We were requested to look at the issue of the Atlantic Herring Management 2 area closure and whether or not there would be an opportunity to reopen that area for any portion of the year. It was closed to directed fishing on April 15th. Based on projections that 95% of the tack would be harvested by that date, our current information indicates that the harvest level fell short of the commercial quota by 5%. We are currently at 90% of the tack. It should be noted that reported cumulative catch without the dealer supplement shows that only 85% of the tack has been harvested. The discrepancy between the dealer supplemented landings and reported landings is due primarily to underestimations of submitted IVR reports. We use the dealer reports as a more accurate representation of the actual amount harvested. So after reviewing the information and mackerel landings for the months of December, the issue is to allow some bycatch in the mackerel fishery in December. We determined that it would be appropriate to reopen Area 2 on or about December 1st. And the only other thing I would mention is John mentioned in his report that we were recommending a video conference with the Canadians for the intersessional TMGC. The Canadians have indicated a strong interest in having a face-to-face meeting and have volunteered to come down and meet in the Portland area. And so Tom Warren's working with TMGC members to see if that is an option. And that's all I have. Thanks.
Questions for Pat? Dr. Pierce.
Yes, sorry, Pat. I had trouble hearing some of what you said. Did you give us a projection date for a closure of the Herring 1A fishery?
No. I wasn't talking about the Herring 1A fishery. I was talking about potentially reopening the Herring Area 2 fishery because the tack ended up lower than what we'd projected when we closed in April.
Do you have a projection date for the Area 1A fishery?
I don't.
Also, I didn't quite understand what you said regarding the restrictions for midwater pier trawling in the closed area relative to slippage. Did you say there was some exception to slippage if the dogfish was in the net?
There's an exception if the dogfish clog the fish pump.
Yeah, I actually want to put it on the record to congratulate Pat's staff for the letter they sent out on herring in that closed area. It's very well written. It strikes a very good balance between safety at sea and our need to know what people have caught. The question I was going to ask is, has anybody actually fished in that area since the letter was issued?
I don't know. We could find out, but I don't know.
Okay. I'd just like to know. I mean, I don't think they have because they're all up where we are, but from what I've seen. But I'm kind of curious to see what the results of that letter are as to how people have responded to it.
Terry, then Jim.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a follow-up for David's question about the Area 1A. Fleet did about 3,700 metric tons last week, and we're up to around 33.3. Matt projects they'll still close around the same time, first to second week of December.
Jenny?
Yeah, I want to just thank Pat and the staff for the yellowtail closure and not taking the whole Area 4. I know they looked in details of trying to minimize the area that was closed, but something definitely had to be done, and they minimized it as much as possible. Apparently, the discards rates were like 800% in that area on yellowtail, so it's they did a good job. Thank you.
Anyone else? Mike Leary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pat, regarding data corrections, has there been any corrections to date? And I have a lot of people that have bought permits that have the data that was sent to them by the statistical office, but they don't have the dealer reports. I mean, is there any way you can send a letter out to say what's going to be accepted and what's not going to be accepted to save people a lot of time and anguish?
Thought I had the information handy, but I don't. There have been some data corrections already. I want to say we've gotten 66 requests so far, something like that. A fairly low number from our perspective, that out of the 1,480 potential requests. A handful of them have been completed. We've been actually trying to talk with people one-on-one instead of sending out a letter. So I would encourage folks to give a call, and we'll have staff sit down with them. Thanks.
David.
Follow-up to Mike's question. Victor Vecchio is the person who is dealing with this. I've spoken with him several times. I think staff is doing a very good job of trying to ferret out the problems. They've already identified a number of them. Some of them are corrections that can be applied fleet-wide. Some of them are kind of one-off things. Overall, I think a lot of progress has been made. And I don't think the problem is nearly as big as I thought it was 6 months ago. So I have some hope that we can actually get accurate data here reasonably soon.
Pat, you said out of the entire cadre of groundfish permits, only 66 people are challenging the landings history. Did I hear that right?
So far, and in fact, the reason we extended the deadline is I think by the deadline we'd had, I don't know, less than 50.
That's unbelievable to me.
Yeah.
The fire and brimstone, the articles, the claims that the sky was falling, and 66 people have challenged their landings history. How many challenged their history in general category scallop?
How many we had... I don't have the number of appeals.
I think it was more than 66.
Yeah, it was definitely more than 66.
Maybe somebody from a newspaper can make sure they insert that in their next article. David?
Well, there are two issues. I mean, one is that if you didn't own the permit the whole time, you really have no way to challenge data because you can't access the other person's information. So a huge number of permits are basically unchallengeable. The second issue is that a number of people in my area anyway are still gathering information. They just are overwhelmed. I mean, if you're a day vote and you have to challenge 10 years of data, you're looking at, I don't know, in my case it was like 1,200 individual landing slips. I mean, the task is daunting on both sides. I mean, it's daunting for the service to verify that the information is challengeable, but it's also daunting for the individual fisherman to find a mistake. So I don't know if that number is going to go up that much. A lot of people have just kind of thrown up their hands and gone, it is what it is. I can't figure this out. But so there, you know, the number of challenges isn't indicative of the level of frustration, I guess is what I'd say.
You know, if I was frustrated and someone said there's an opportunity to relieve yourself of that frustration, I'd deal with it. But I like you, I'm just surprised that the number's so low. That's my point. Mike Leary.
Yeah, I was going to bring mine down the end of the month, but there's a bunch of people out front, and I was afraid to go in.
We would have protected you.
Anyone else for Pat? Maggie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to comment on the agency's decision to impose this restriction on the western U.S. Canada area for vessels using trawl gear. And while I understand the need for the agency to take action, in fact, I spoke with your staff, the week before, and, was questioning when you were going to take some action. I think the action that was taken is very harsh. To ask trawl vessels to use a particular gear and with 4 days' notice is very difficult. These nets, you don't walk in a store and pick up these nets off a shelf. It's essentially to many people saying you can't fish there at all. The rule trawl is a net that can only be fished by very large vessels because of the regulatory description of it, which we have asked twice to be changed so that smaller vessels could tow that trawl. And I think the agency had an opportunity to at least discuss some different options with the Groundfish Committee when they just met and didn't do that. So I understand the need to protect yellowtail, and I was urging the agency to take action, but I think the particular measure that you chose, even though that you did, as Jim said, try to minimize the area where this restriction applies, it is two-thirds of the western U.S.-Canada area. It's a huge area, and I think you're going to have people pushed into other areas where you don't want them as a result of that restriction. Thank you.
Pat?
Well, as Jim indicated, the bycatch rate all of a sudden became quite high. We were very concerned about closing the fishery prematurely. People obviously in the past have been very critical when we haven't acted quickly enough or comprehensively enough. I think in general there is an interest in making sure that there is fish available in the spring, certainly in the March-April time period. And we understand that not everybody has a rule trawl, for example, but this is certainly not the first time we've imposed this restriction either, and it's a tool that we're going to be using regularly. So.
Dr. Pierce, to that point?
Yeah, to that point, I think the action that the service took is understandable, and I think all should pay attention to the nature of the action, since it's very likely that that every trawler better buy this piece of gear, especially when May 1, 2010 comes along and we're faced with similar sorts of closures or actions to be taken prior to a closure of ground fishing throughout the southern New England area to deal with the very low ACLs for at least the common pool vessels.
Jimmy?
Yeah, although it does take a while to get a rule trawl, you can rig a separated trawl in about a day. You know, at least a decent twine guy can. So, I mean, and the separator and rule trawl has been required for 2 or 3 months now in the eastern area, so it's more of an expansion of that than something totally new.
Chris Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chris Brown, Rhode Island Commercial Fishermen Association. 2 points. Rule trawl is a great idea. It's an example of what the industry can do when they're given a chance. You've embraced it by making it a standard, but rule trawl, it's 75% as big as the one that you've approved, is just as effective and more appropriate for a smaller boat. I think you have to liberalize the standards. It's a fantastic tool and should be accepted on in more fisheries. Yellowtails are driving the bus on this problem, and there are other ways to avoid yellowtail catch. Two of the guys that are in my association had just purchased of their own free will and volition a 5-foot net, which is a lot cheaper than a rule trawl. Rule trawls will cost you about $15,000 to $20,000, I think, is a fair number. You can pick up a 5-foot net, a 5-foot face net, and it will avoid yellowtails famously. They did that because they couldn't really afford to buy two rule trawls, and they were going to engineer their way out of the yellowtail problem. But now they have nets that they could ill afford in the back of their truck, riding them around. They can't really use them. I think you have to task the industry with getting the job done. Sectors will do that. How we get from here to there is a little bit of a challenge. The second point was that I think the council and NIMS needs to develop a policy by which a permit could almost be given clear title to what it professes to have in its historical landings locker. Anything shy of that will spook a bank from being willing to finance a permit. You know, we're in a system now where, you know, money can cure the problem. You can buy quota, you can buy permits, and trying to go to a bank and borrow money for a permit that hasn't gotten validated history or clear title to, or could be subject to some sort of correction, is a challenge. Banks are a little, I don't know if you've been in lately, they're a little shaky. We make them nervous on a good day. So when I go in there with a permit that has, you know, scrolls out and it's got all this glorious history, and there's all this talk about errors in the system and whatnot, it makes them very reluctant to want to invest in the vision that I have of my own future. So maybe some sort of a policy with regard to sanctioning landings or identifying landings and validating them, rather, could go a long way to making banks breathe at a regular base, regular pace, rather. So that's it. Thank you.
Anyone else for Pat? David?
Well, just a follow-up to Chris's statement. Is there going to be a date at which time we can say that catch history is the vessel's history? Have we set that date yet?
I don't understand the question.
Well, we're in the process of correcting errors, and we've set a date at which time you have to submit requests for corrections, but will there be a date sometime in the future and at which time we could say that this is the history of that vessel? That, you know, it's kind of like days at sea now. I mean, we days at sea is set. You can't appeal them. It is what it is. Is there going to be a point at which we can say catch history is the same thing?
Well, the date is the date by which someone needs to submit a correction to have that correction considered for the 2011 PSCs. So I think the real answer to the question is probably not. That we're always going to be in a situation where we're correcting this information. We're just going to be using these dates as cutoff dates for when the next round of use of the information. So the December 31st date is the cutoff date for changes for the 2011 fishing year. That doesn't stop someone from coming in after that date and requesting a change for the 2012 fishing year.
Okay. To Chris's point, I mean, at some point you'll be able to say this is the catch history. What you won't be able to say is this is the sector contribution, because that number is going to change every time somebody comes in and requests a change in their history, because if somebody else goes up, you go down, basically, if yours is static. So I think, you know, if you're going to a bank and you're bringing in somebody's vessel history, you can say this history is correct as of this date, and you know, basically if they're uncomfortable with that, they should probably contact the service and say, you know, what are the potential changes that can occur here? Well, I know you're laughing, and you know, I don't know whether to laugh or cry, but yeah, I mean, it's the fact is that what Pat said is true. As long as somebody comes in and challenges their history, until we set a date at which time we say history is unchallengeable, which we haven't done, then, you know, if somebody else goes up, you're going down by some percentage if yours is fixed. You know, I understand the bank's squeamishness. I never tried to borrow money against anything to do with fishing anymore. I you know, it's either use your house or use some other collateral. I mean, it just...
At some point, we'd like to transition to being a real business. And in that, we have to dry up the squeamishness or the willingness of the bank to look at it. And that, right now, is to me a kind of a red flag.
Yeah. I understand, and I'm trying to air out both sides of the issue so that, that everybody understands them for the record.
Any other questions for Pat? Okay, thank you, Pat. Mean Gene?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to bring you up to date with the various lawsuits involving the New England Council actions. In the Lovegren versus Locke case, which challenged the interim rule in groundfish, all the motions and briefs for summary judgment have been submitted to the court, and we're just awaiting a decision by the court as to whether there will be an oral hearing or a decision. In a group of scallopers versus Locke, which challenged Amendment 11, the limited access general category amendment, all the briefs are in. We had a hearing scheduled for that case tomorrow. This is in Trenton Federal District Court, but that has been postponed now until probably later in January, so we won't be getting a decision in that case for some time. In Oceana versus Locke, which challenged the SBRM amendment several years ago, the plaintiffs have filed their summary judgment brief. They included a new affidavit by their hired expert, and we have challenged whether that's an appropriate document to be considered in this case, and essentially asked the court not to consider it, and the court is still considering that challenge. Once that's done, then we will continue with the briefing in the case and await the decision thereafter. And that's in the D.C. District. In the Midcoast versus Locke case, which challenged our denial of a petition by herring fishery interest, the petition for rulemaking to essentially close groundfish closed areas to herring midwater trawl fishing. All briefs have been filed, and we're still waiting a decision by the court for either a hearing or just a decision. In the Western Sea case, which challenges herring amendment 1, that case had been briefed, and an oral hearing was held over a year ago, year and a half ago, and it was essentially dismissed without prejudice, suspended, because the judge found that the case wasn't yet ripe. The plaintiffs had not exhausted their administrative appeals for their herring amendment. But that case has been recently reactivated. The court decided to allow supplemental briefing in the case, and which we are almost through with, and there's a hearing scheduled, oral hearing scheduled by the court in Boston at the end of the month, November 30th, on that case. So we should get a decision soon thereafter. That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Secretary Locke seems pretty busy.
Yeah, I don't think it's Secretary Locke. I think it's lawyers.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for Gene. I'm just forgetting what the basis of the Western Sea challenge to Amendment 1 is. Could you just go over that briefly?
Yes, that's a challenge to the permit splitting provision only. It challenged the legality and the rationale for disallowing permit splitting by vessels that applied for the new limited access permit. In that case, the plaintiffs are claiming that they had split off their open access herring permit before Amendment 1 came into place and wanted to apply for a separate permit under the limited access system in herring based on that split off open access permit, even though the vessel that earned that history also had history that qualified the vessel for other limited access permits. So it's a challenge to the permit splitting provision.
Any other questions for Gene? David?
In that particular case, Gene, is the boat allowed to fish while this is being litigated, or are they not allowed to fish?
Yes, while their appeals are still being considered, and there are still a handful of appeals that have not been fully resolved in there, so they are allowed to fish until their appeal, their administrative appeal is concluded, not waiting for the lawsuit to be concluded.
That actually raises another question. How many boats in Herring still have appeals pending? Have they been solved yet?
Do you know? There's not very many, but there's...
I'm not aware of any pending appeals on Herring. Are you confusing it with scallops?
Maybe I am, yeah.
I think you are.
Herring, right.
Herring are done.
Okay, now the reason I ask is I saw a boat the other day, and I said, it's like a ghost from the past fishing. I said, geez, that's why I was curious.
Well, I think there might be two or three that are still, but we can check. I mean, it's no use speculating on it.
Any other questions for Gene? All right, move on to the Science Center. Dr. Jim or Nancy? Dr. Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll start out by reviewing some of the surveys and then go on to talk about stock assessments. With the Bigelow, it conducted its first bottom trawl survey in the spring of 2009, and it's in the last stages of completing the fall bottom trawl survey for this year. One interesting catch, 33 lionfish were captured in this survey in a single tow south of Cape Hatteras. And this compares to a total of 10 lionfish that were caught in the previous 70,000 bottom trawl tows done by the center during the complete time series that we've been surveying. So the definitely on the increase, the lionfish appear to be on the increase. And I know that this is also an issue in the Caribbean as well. The there was a review of the calibration data that were collected to relate the two vessels, the Albatross to the Bigelow, and that review was conducted in Woods Hole by an independent review panel in August of 2009. And as a result of that meeting, some calibration coefficients were computed for different stocks, and some of them were fairly confident in using those, and others present real challenges, and additional data analysis will be required to interpret the data. And the center is prepared at any of your future meetings to present a summary of that meeting and summarize the results. On the Herring Acoustic Survey, the annual survey was completed on October the 15th of 2009. The survey was conducted with the NOAA ship Delaware II using a multi-frequency echo sounder and a midwater trawl for species identification and bottom trawl and for biological data. George's Bank was the primary survey area, and the acoustic and biological data from these surveys are generally available at the end of December. Then switching to talking about a gear study, the center is in the midst of doing a cooperative research project on the catchability of the rockhopper sweep and the cookie sweep. And it's being conducted in southern New England waters. And after the data are collected in southern New England, there are plans to compare the two gears as well on George's Bank and in the Gulf of Maine. Regarding the NEMAP study, there's an exchange going on between scientific personnel. Jim Gartlin, who is pretty much the chief scientist from VIMS on the NEMAP survey, has gone on the NEFSC spring bottom trawl survey, and Russell Brown, who's the chief of our survey, has gone on the NEMAP survey. So they're out there communicating and seeing how the two surveys, what their procedures are. Then this is from our social science branch. They're initiating a study that's related to social and economic catch share performance measures. And you'll be hearing more about this at future meetings. I believe Drew Kitts will be coming to the council at one of your future meetings to talk about this. But the idea is to identify key areas of research and data collection to track the social and economic performance of catch shares in the Northeast region. So they've already made a few presentations to the Northeast Regional Office staff and to the Northeast Consortium, and they're planning future presentations with both councils and other groups. And the idea will be to gather information on fishermen and fishing communities and seeing how that's impacting in social science aspects. And then also they'll be planning to expand that and also collect data on not only the sectors, but expanding it to people who are not in the sectors as well. So you'll be hearing more about that at future meetings. On stock assessment, we have a SARC 49 coming up. The meeting will begin in Woods Hole on November the 30th, and it lasts until December the 3rd. The two species on the agenda for that SARC are Atlantic surf clam and butterfish, and those are both benchmark stock assessments. There was the next SARC after that, SARC 50, is scheduled for June 1st to the 4th in 2010. And on that agenda, there are three benchmark assessments: sea scallop, monkfish, and pollock. And then for SARC 51 in December of 2010, there are four stocks on the agenda for benchmark assessments: Lalago and the three hake species, silver, red, and offshore. We're also busy doing track. Some of the species in the track, there was a mackerel data meeting in late October of this year. There is a track benchmark meeting scheduled for dogfish on January the 25th to the 29th of 2010. A mackerel track benchmark assessment scheduled for March the 1st through March the 5th of 2010. And then a track Eastern Georges Bank cod, Eastern Georges Bank haddock, and Georges Bank yellowtail meeting scheduled for July 19th to the 23rd of 2010. And we will also be conducting assessment updates on a number of mid-Atlantic stocks this late spring. That concludes my report. Thank you.
Thank you. Nancy, did you have any comments that you wanted to make?
Just one thing I wanted to add, and that is I think everybody's aware that we recently published a paper. In fact, I'm looking up the citation now, and I can obviously pass that along, that has generated a lot of interest. And what we did is we looked at distributions of several stocks, 40-some stocks in the Northeast, and looked at distributional shifts. And of those 40-some stocks, 36 demonstrated some significant changes in their distribution. So I think that's something that people might be interested in taking a look at, but it seems to have generated, again, a lot of interest, particularly in the agency. But I did want to add that. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you. Just a comment on the acoustic survey that took place in September. And in this particular year, the acoustic survey on Georges Bank coincided with some significant fishing activity as well. I don't know why it hasn't happened in the past, but I got a lot of feedback from captains on fishing vessels who noticed the Delaware on the grounds and, you know, called me up, and I explained what the survey was all about. And comments I got were, I guess, somewhat typical. Well, if they're surveying for herring, I'm catching herring over here, and they're over there, and there are no herring over there. And so, you know, I did try to explain, you know, the basis for the survey and the need to have a design and what was going on, and encourage captains if they had, you know, any feedback when they were out there to call the vessel. And one captain says, oh, you know, that's, we can't do that. We can't call the vessel. And I said, well, no, I think you can. You know, I think that's perfectly fine. You know, pick up the mic and call the Delaware. I think you can do that. But it did highlight for me some lack of understanding within the industry about the survey. And I think the Science Center in the past, particularly when they initiated the survey, did reach out to the industry and for some participation and didn't get a positive response, primarily because the survey is taking place at a time in which they are all very busy. So I think that there would be some value to trying to perhaps hold a very informal meeting with some of the people that participate in the acoustic survey with the industry at a time that they aren't busy. I mean, you know, September is a really busy time for them, and maybe in March or something like that, we could all sit down, because, you know, my response to the industry was, well, quite frankly, the agency did reach out to all of us. I sent an email to all of you. They invited you to go on this survey if you wanted to go, and you all responded that you were too busy. So maybe if we just tried to, like, do it at a different time of the year, it might be helpful, because they did, they really picked up on it this year in a way they hadn't in the past.
David?
Yeah, Jim, we're
Nancy.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on that. We have obviously been having some informal discussions, but I agree. I think what we need to do is formalize those informal discussions to the extent that we can figure out when the optimum time is for us, obviously, to go out. And we have had some questions and concerns about not only the timing of our surveys, but the spatial extent. And in terms of where it is that we're surveying as well. And obviously we've had discussions with industry folks. And so I agree. I think what we do need to do is sit down and actually formalize that discussion and actually work it out in terms of our piece, industry's piece, other people's piece, in terms of doing these surveys, so that we can, in fact, get information that we all have confidence in, particularly relative to spawning. So I think that would be a good idea.
Yeah, I've got Jim, but before I ask my questions of you, I just wanted to comment that this exchange between Nancy and Mary Beth is a very good one. Very pleased to see the communication between the center and the industry regarding sea herring, especially with the idea that this particular research will be very helpful for looking into the spawning question, spawning herring question, and the benchmark assessment. Jim, for sea herring, is not scheduled yet. You didn't mention that in your report, so I assume that there's no date yet for the sea herring benchmark assessment, an assessment that would benefit greatly, I suppose, from this this acoustic work. So could you elaborate a bit?
Yeah, there in fact is a date that it is scheduled. It's just that I didn't go out far enough in time. The herring is scheduled for June of 2012, and that would be SARC 54. And at the NRCC meeting that was held a month ago, there was discussion about scheduling and bringing the herring from the track into the SARC review process. And in doing so, we had to consider other species and priorities among species, and this was where it fit in.
Okay, but I wish it was earlier than June 2012, but if getting it out of the track process and into the SARSOC process results in that delay, then perhaps it's a good thing. I would rather have it in that particular forum than in the track forum, where the Canadian scientists appear to have too much influence based upon what I've seen so far. Anyways, you mentioned the calibration work. And certainly the center provided a very good update on calibration work a few months ago, maybe more than a few months ago, giving us some insight into what sort of results we might have, Bigelow versus the albatross. You indicated that there's some confidence in, I guess, in getting some calibration factors for some species, but for others there will be real challenges. I guess my first question relative to that is, the report that was prepared regarding all this calibration work, is it available on the center's website? And the nature of these real challenges, what does that mean relative to the center getting some usable calibration factors for all these other stocks? How long might that take? Any speculation?
Nancy?
Yeah, not surprising. There are some issues, obviously, with some of the stocks relative to calibration going from the albatross to the Bigelow. And quite frankly, for some of those stocks, I think, realistically, what we have to do is consider alternative survey platforms. I think a good example is probably Pollock. And, you know, we've started a discussion, for example, with industry folks about moving towards an industry-based survey. So I think to some extent we'll be able to move through some of these calibration issues for some of these stocks, but for others, I think what it means is, again, looking at alternative platforms and including things like industry-based surveys. So, you know, we're working through that now for the most part. I think we're in pretty good shape moving from the albatross to the Bigelow. But there are a few stocks, I won't say there's very many of them, that we do have concerns, and we're exploring alternative methods.
Okay, thank you, Nancy. Is that report available on the web yet, or is it still in development?
I don't know. Jim would know that.
No, there is a report that we have received. It's not on our website yet, but I'm working to get it posted on the website. And I'd just like to point out one concrete example that for the dogfish assessment that the center's been working on for January, there is a calibration coefficient already for dogfish that's been computed, and that was an example that worked out and had pretty tight confidence intervals, so we were able to use that immediately. But I think that rather than getting ahead of myself, it would be better to have Wendy Gabriel or someone else come here and actually give you a summary of the meeting.
Okay, thank you. Look forward to that report regarding dogfish. I've seen the comparable data, and I'm not as comfortable with the calibration factor, but I await some formal discussion from the center regarding that particular issue, because it will pose some interesting, I have some questions. My final question is relative to NEMAP. I know that NEMAP is becoming increasingly important in the assessment picture. I also understand that those involved with NEMAP, VIMS, the researchers who are doing such an excellent job with NEMAP, are going to be testing the trawl They're going to test, I think, a half version of the trawl that is used by the Bigelow. And my question is the center going to be involved in that particular testing work to provide the center expertise that will be necessary? The reason why I ask this is that if indeed this work goes forward and it is successful, it might be a trawl that we would want to incorporate into our own state trawl work so we can be as consistent and complementary as possible with the center.
Yes, we're working very closely with the NEMAP folks, and I mean, it's one reason why we've had this exchange in terms of scientists on various surveys. So, unfortunately, when we really wanted to do a lot of this gear comparison work between the Albatross and the Bigelow, but then the Albatross ended up disappearing a year earlier than we anticipated, and therefore we weren't able to do the kinds of gear comparison or use both kinds of gear, for example, you know, with the Bigelow, and do those kinds of comparisons. So we start when we understood that the Albatross was going to disappear earlier. We actually started talking with NEMAP and some other folks as well about the possibility, and other industry folks, quite frankly, in terms of the possibility of doing these kinds of gear comparisons. And so we are moving forward. We're working with NEMAP folks. We're also working with some other industry folks, looking at the likelihood of doing some further gear comparison studies as well on other kinds, on a variety of stocks. Yeah, obviously, there's some real interest in some of the more problematic stocks. And so we've been moving forward.
Mark Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. I want to follow up a little bit more on where Dave Pierce was going relative to the herring assessment. I'm very uncomfortable with the herring stock assessment and the decisions we had to make earlier this week as a result of it. What was supposed to have been a assessment update turned into considerably more than that, with perturbations caused by new catch data, several years of catch data, reconstitution of historical catch data, surveys being considered in and out. And frankly, the uncertainty in the assessment retrospective pattern got exacerbated as a result of the suite of decisions that were made, and then we were left with a very difficult situation to be. And I can't understand, given the weakness of that assessment, how that's not queued up sooner than 2012. And I think this board ought to express some opinions about that. If they share mine, I think we need to tackle that sooner than that. Thank you.
Nancy?
Well, obviously, we're aware that there are concerns about the timing of the herring assessment. You need to be aware that, obviously, the timing of the assessment in the SARC schedule is not set by us alone. And it is a decision through a negotiation process, obviously, with the NRCC. And when we looked at the whole suite of priorities between the two councils and including the Atlantic states, because we have a lot of people that are involved and, in fact, have the lead responsibilities for assessments under Atlantic states, the earliest that we agreed as an NRCC that we could do it would be in 2012. Now, saying that, the earliest that we're saying we can do it in 2012 includes a full evaluation of what we see as the biggest issue, and that is that retrospective pattern. And so, for example, it's my understanding, I wasn't there, but I've talked with Paul about this a number of times, and Gary Shepard, the people who were involved in the assessment. And for example, there was a decision that was made to exclude a couple of surveys. We went ahead and did the assessment, including those two surveys, for example. It made no difference as far as the results were concerned. So it was clear to us that as far as this assessment and the results are concerned, the overwhelming issue is dealing with the retrospective pattern. And what that means is time. It's going to take us time to evaluate the retrospective pattern, which means looking at a series of models and doing a series of sensitivity analyses relative to models. And so since that is the overwhelming issue, that is going to take some time. Now, saying that as well, if we were to bump up the herring survey again, the schedule is set by the NRCC, which means that other stocks would get bumped. For example, if we were to bump it up to December of 2011, I believe that what we would look at is potentially bumping Fluke, summer flounder, and three stocks of winter flounder, for example. Those are currently on the SARC schedule for December of 2011. Are those going to be bumped? If we were to move it up to June 2011, there's a series of stocks as well. So it is not a unilateral decision. It is a consensus. It's negotiated by the NRCC. And so collectively, we came to the decision that the earliest we could do it within the other priorities is June of 2012.
Mark, just to your comment, I just wanted to indicate that our chair made a very strong case at NRCC for trying to get that done as early as possible. But I think, as Nancy said, it is somewhat of a balancing act with other regions and ASMFC as to what those priorities are. Next, I had Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, we voted yesterday to start an amendment to look at the interactions with scallop and groundfish on sharing the allocation of the yellowtail, the flounder stocks. Yellowtail, Georges Bank yellowtail, Southern New England yellowtail, and Cape Cod Gulf of Maine. Now, in terms of timing, we're getting a benchmark assessment for Georges Bank yellowtail that we'll get the results in July of 2010. And what about in 2010? Are there any scheduled updates or benchmarks for Southern New England yellowtail or Cape Cod yellowtail? Just so the council knows, I can't recall that.
No, there are not.
Mary Beth? Okay. Jim and then Dave.
Yes, this is to the Science Center. I recently attended the council training session in Washington, D.C., and I noticed quite obviously that in the Northwest Atlantic, a very large percentage of the survey work is done by charter vessels, i.e. commercial vessels, versus the NOAA vessels. And here it's just the opposite. We do very little commercial charter and a huge amount of NOAA. And I think that has become a problem here in a lot of different ways, and a lot of it's buy-in from the industry. And I encourage you to utilize the industry. And, you know, if you need industry to do pollock, that's great. But the more you use the industry, the more buy-in you're going to get, more easier every jobs, maybe get better data. And I'd also like to see myself, if we're having trouble calibrating the ship, we need a side-by-side industry survey, and that can help calibrate. But anyway, I saw a stark difference. I mean, huge. And charters versus NOAA from the West Coast to the East Coast. And I'd like to
Nancy.
See it more than...
Nancy?
Well, for the most part, the reason that particularly the Northwest Center does a lot of charter work is because there are four science centers on the West Coast and fewer NOAA vessels. And what we are doing as an agency is building more vessels. The first two came to the East Coast, but the next four or five, only one more vessel comes to the East Coast, and the rest are going to go to the West Coast. So it's not because of a preference to go with charters. It's because of the lack of availability of big white boats. Their preference is to use big white boats, and they will once they come online. And the first two vessels for the West Coast are going to be coming online within the next 2 years, and they will be used preferentially to charters. Now, that doesn't mean that there are opportunities to work with the industry and do charter work. I agree. There clearly are times when it's preferable to implement an industry-based or a charter survey. But the reason they're not going in that direction more is because there are white boats coming online and they will be using them.
Yeah, Nancy, you referenced a study about movement of fish stocks, and just to this be like a suggestion, at least one Boston radio station apparently either read that study on your website, or if you issued a press release, they read that. I don't know. However, the end result was they totally mischaracterized it, and they were telling their readers that they wouldn't be able to eat cod or haddock because they're going to swim off to places that fishermen can't catch them. As a Boston radio station, my wife called me up when I was out fishing, and you know, when she was on her way to a school to give her talks, and you know, she was all upset because the teachers were asking her about it, and you know, is this true that you know fish are going to swim off the edge of the world and be uncatchable? So my suggestion would be that perhaps you have Terry Frady or somebody issue a press release explaining in layman's terms what the study really does say and what it doesn't say, so that people aren't being told that they won't be able to eat fish anymore because they're going to go to places that fishermen can't catch them.
Nancy?
Yeah, just quickly, I appreciate that, and I will talk with Terry. But, you know, I mean, we're publishing a paper, and, you know, I'm saying that we're looking at shifts in distributions, which are things that you guys obviously are aware of and have known for an awfully long time. So, but I will talk with Terry about that.
My point is that people mischaracterize studies all the time, and in this case, they, at least in the case of this radio station, they totally mischaracterized it to the point where they were alarming people. And, you know, teachers are asking questions, so if teachers are asking questions, then, you know, lay people are probably taking away the wrong message from the study.
Terry Stockwell, then we're going to move on to the next.
Yeah, Nancy and Jim, could you refresh my memory of what benchmarks are scheduled for next year?
Yeah, for SARC 50, which is in June of 2010, benchmarks for sea scallop, monkfish, and pollock. For SARC 51 in December 2010, lolago, silver hake, red hake, and offshore hake. Should I do 2011 as well? Okay. SARC 52, June of 2011, summer flounder, and the three winter flounder stocks, Gulf of Maine, Georges Bank, and southern New England. SARC 53 in December of 2011, black sea bass, Gulf of Maine cod, and an analysis of signposts, which is something you haven't heard about much yet as a council, but something that some working groups are working on. And that will be equivalent to analyzing a stock assessment on a SARC. So that takes you through 2010 and 2011.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Science Center. I'll just ask Paul Howard if we can get a copy of the updated SARC schedule. We can put it in the binder for the next, or Chris, or whomever, for the next council meeting. Thank you. Moving on, Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council Liaison. Nothing from Frank. Rick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just start by thanking you all for your hospitality this week. It's been a pleasure to be with you. Several of you have told me that as long as last night's meeting was, it was an outlier and that it did not last until midnight. But it has been a pleasure to be with you. We did have our last meeting in Ocean City, and that was our first live web meeting that was webcast, and so we're trying to increase public access and transparency for our meetings by doing that.
I did assure our web viewers that I promised that the meeting would be at least as exciting as C-SPAN 3, and I think our Nielsen ratings reflected that level of excitement. We had 7 viewers by the end of the first day. So we count that a success. At the October meeting, we did cover several important issues. We're trying to integrate the monitoring committee into the SSC process on the front end of the ABC setting process as it relates to our council's activities. And so we did meet jointly with the ASMFC's leadership, and we're going to have a process whereby we have a pre-decisional consultation between the monitoring committee and the SSC to consider assessment updates and benchmarks prior to the ABC making an, or prior to the SSC making its ABC recommendation to the council. We also discussed a draft risk policy for the council as it would relate to the proposed ABC control rules that the SSC is developing. And finally, we had a hearing on a consideration of 6 proposed sites that would go into the MPA network. We did not have any attendance at that hearing, but we are getting a lot of interest now that the second hearing is scheduled, which would be a final final hearing and action at our December meeting. We're scheduled to meet in December from the 8th to the 10th in Wilmington, Delaware. On the first day of the meeting, we'll be considering recreational measures for summer flounder, scup, and other species. I know Frank Blount's planning on attending that meeting. And then on the 9th, we'll be meeting with all of our committees to discuss proposed accountability measures that would go into our ACLAM omnibus amendment. The omnibus amendment has been our focal point during the last year, and we had a meeting, we had a one-day meeting on July 14th with all of the committees to discuss ACL structures. We then went back to the FMAT, and we've requested advice on the development of AM packages to accompany those ACL structures. We'll be considering those at the committee level on December the 9th. And then we'll come back at our February meeting and discuss the ABC control rules to address the scientific uncertainty. And then presumably at our April meeting, hopefully we will have a public hearing document that's ready to go that will reflect the work of all the committees on ACLs and AMs. So that concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Rick. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Rick, thanks. I'm very glad to see how the Mid-Atlantic Council is moving forward regarding the interrelationship between the SSC and the monitoring committees. It's a good approach. Thanks for doing that. You indicated that 6 sites have been added to the MPA network of the Mid-Atlantic Council. Would you elaborate, what does that mean when a site is put into the network? What does that mean for the site specifically relative to rules and regulations or whatever else?
Well, David, we've had one hearing, and we're proposed to have a second hearing at the December meeting. The MPA network, if the sites are added to the network, the existing regulations don't change. In other words, the council and collectively with the service retain their management authority over those sites. The existing regulations remain in place, so there's not per se an additional layer of protection or any new regulatory initiative that follows from that designation, but it does put it into the national network of MPAs, and again, the council continues to retain its management authority over the existing regulations.
Is it related in any way to HAPCs, so that you'll have to look at those areas and develop specific rules and regulations consistent with an HAPC strategy?
David, HAPCs or GRAs, things of that nature are would be candidates for adding those types of sites to the MPA network. The network does, or the executive order does require that there's a management plan for that site, but the management plan would be satisfied by the existing FMP and related regulations. So it would not require a redundant layer of management planning that I'm aware of. In other words, the existing regulations would remain in place, and perhaps the service can comment on that too.
Sally.
I was just wondering if we could have a little more elaboration on your discussion about risk policy, and sounds like it was an initial discussion or in the early stages, but I'm just wondering what the expectation or hope is for incorporating that into your decision-making.
Thank you, Sally. At this point, we have had a couple of preliminary discussions about risk policies. And part of the challenge is, you know, if you're trying to apply that portion of the NS1 guidelines, the council has an opportunity, and it's basically a policy call to express a tolerance for risk to the SSC in its application of the ABC control rules. And so we're trying to determine how we might express that in a way that would be compatible with the proposed ABC control rules that the SSC is developing. So we have a scientific uncertainty subcommittee within our SSC, and their draft recommendations at this point are to have a tiered approach to ABC control rules. And so they would have four tiers that range at the lowest from data-poor situations, which would reflect relatively ad hoc approaches, to more robust situations where they have preferred and then ideal levels of assessments. So we're trying to develop a risk policy that would match up with the tiered approach. So what we're considering doing is expressing a tolerance for risk basically in a matrix, and the axes of that matrix would be data quality, that is assessment, the four different assessment tiers, and then stock status, such that we would be willing to accept higher levels of risk at higher levels of stock abundance and higher levels of risk at better levels of information quality. Now that's very much a draft type of discussion at this point. And frankly, after the SSC meeting last week, you know, there is significant interest in trying to figure out how to simultaneously consider those types of factors, but also consider the economic consequences associated with buffering. And so, for example, with the work that you saw in, Devorah Hart's paper, on scallops, you know, she did an analysis of ABC and looked at lost yield and risk of overfishing. So you were simultaneously in that analysis considering the risk of overfishing and how that related to lost yield and potentially, you know, the economic consequences there. And so in Amendment 15, you have at least at this point a proposed ABC control rule that would be a PSTAR 0.25. That is, in a sense, an expression of risk tolerance, but it also takes into account lost yield and the economic considerations. So, you know, exactly how this will evolve is not clear, but we're going to continue to work with the Scientific Uncertainty Subcommittee and look to them for guidance, because on the one hand, it's a policy call, but that policy should be informed by science. And so we're trying to work through that right now.
Just to follow up to that, Mr. Chairman, obviously we're struggling with figuring out how to be comfortable with the advice that our SSC is giving. And, you know, while the sounds like the Mid-Atlantic is in the process of figuring out how to evaluate what the SSC provides them based on the level of the depth and quality of the scientific information provided, you know, I think it's really important that we consider this too. I mean, it ultimately can make it much clearer why the council is making decisions based on the kind of information that the SSC has to work with. So I would just encourage, as we're trying to figure out how to work much more effectively with our SSC. Obviously, it's been a struggle for this council over the last couple of months. To really get it right and get comfortable with this new approach. I think some of the ideas that are in the early stages of being explored in the mid in terms of the comfort with risk and comfort with taking a more risky approach or desire to be more risk averse is something that we need to be very clearly considering in how the SSC is providing information so that everybody understands why we're taking their advice and not continually sending it back for further evaluation. Thank you.
So at that point, I
I've been, well, we approved our priorities on Tuesday, and of course I have my own priorities as the chair, and that's one of them, is to put more of a working framework around the relationship and improve the relationship between the SSC and our existing process, so things such as risk tolerance, things such as rationale for remand, things of that nature, and constantly working with the chair of the SSC and our staff, and also getting in a place where we can come back to the, I can come back to the council and lay out some of the types of discussions that Rick's already leading his council through. So I'm in the same place on that. All right, Beth.
Thank you. When we were talking earlier on the Science Center report, I passed because my frustration level with the herring assessment is extremely high, and I thought my comments might not be all that constructive. So I passed. But this discussion is interesting to me in that when you talk about you know, the tiers of our knowledge on the different assessments, it is what they do in the North Pacific. They have four tiers. It is helpful. It does. I think it also highlights, you know, when the NRCC talks about what's important and what species they need to be prioritizing, it could be quite helpful feeding into that process as well. And I'm assuming that those people in the mid are looking towards that North Pacific process and that tiered approach. And perhaps it would be helpful if we also did.
Thanks, Mary Beth. Chris?
In response to Sally's comment, the SSC is anticipating looking at control rules. For some of the stocks and FMPs, it's only come up with interim ABC recommendations. So I think as it more formally looks for control rules, it will be engaging with the council in the discussion of the level of risk that the council is comfortable with.
Okay. Maggie.
Thank you. I just had a question for the chairman of the Mid-Atlantic Council. It's my understanding that the MID has begun some discussions of developing a catch-share program for the squid fishery, and if that is the case, can you give me some idea of where that, what the stage of the development is?
Indeed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have initiated such, or we've agreed to initiate such an action, but frankly, I think the timing of that will probably be initiated in the first half of next year. Because, again, at our December meeting, we've already got a full agenda dealing with the rec measures and the AMs, and our immediate focus is on the timely completion of the omnibus. So I would think that the initiation of that will begin in the first half of next year.
Chris?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could, I'd like to address the gentleman from the Mid-Atlantic. Mr. Robbins, my name is Christopher Brown. I'm the president of the Commercial Fishermen's Association of Rhode Island, lifelong fisherman. We have a winter flounder crisis up here now. Our fishery is closed, not exclusively by any means, but one of the frustrations that we have as concerned fishermen is that one of the programs that the Mid-Atlantic Council developed and provided us with is at the heart of a high discard problem of winter flounder. That would be the small mesh exemption for fluke that is allowed to be prosecuted in our area. Although it is a very good program, when it's prosecuted outside of the range of winter flounder, anytime you drop a net down on the bottom and target flounders of any kind with small mesh, it has the potential to have a very bad discard problem. So I will probably ask the chairman of this council to write a letter to the MID requesting that you review that and maybe make some modifications to it to be in greater consideration of one of the problems that we have. I guess that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Ma'am, Mr. Chair, Chris, thanks for bringing that to my attention. I'll be glad to follow up with you as well as John on this issue.
Okay, we're on to U.S. Coast Guard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. For those of you who haven't had the pleasure of meeting yet, my name is Captain Pete DeCola. I'm the lead Captain Joe McGinnis, the Chief of Law Enforcement for the 1st District a little over 2 months ago. Captain McGinnis is still with the 1st Coast Guard District team. He's currently serving as the Chief of Incident Management Division and running the search and rescue program for the Northeastern United States. Captain McGinnis intended on being here today to introduce me and say his goodbyes, but unfortunately his duties require his presence elsewhere this week. He did ask me to send his regards to the council and his gratitude for the privilege of serving you for the past 3 years. Next slide. The statistics on this slide for the period from September 1st to November 9th. During the period, the Coast Guard conducted 467 boardings. During those boardings, we issued 7 fisheries violations, resulting in an observed compliance rate of 98.5%. In those same 467 boardings, 88 commercial fishing vessels were issued 199 safety violations, resulting in an observed compliance rate of 81.2%. There were also 11 safety terminations. The majority of these terminations involve non-traditional commercial fishing vessels operating under the commercial Atlantic bluefin tuna permit. Again, next slide, please. For the period of September 1st through November 9th, Coast Guard responded to 34 fishing vessel casualties. A breakdown of these casualties is listed on the slide. And while responding to these casualties, 62 lives were saved. Life rafts, immersion suits, and EPIRBs continue to be the leading life-saving equipment. And unfortunately, 5 lives were lost during this period as well. Next slide, please. Previous slide, sorry. Shifting gears to preventative measures, it's important to emphasize that safety at sea is a partnership between the Coast Guard and all mariners, especially true for the fishing industry. One aspect of that partnership is the ongoing commercial fishing vessel safety examination program. During the same 1 September to November, 9 November time frame, 203 exams were conducted and 154 decals were issued. And the other item of note is a new fishing vessel stability training initiative we recently implemented. Recognizing that nearly half of the fishing vessel fatalities in the 1st District over the past 16 years are due to stability-related issues like sinkings and capsizings, the 1st District designed and implemented a training program geared toward fishermen and intended to focus on preventing the common causes of fishing vessel fatalities through education. Through the month of October, we hosted 7 outreach sessions throughout the Northeast as part of what we call the Upright and Watertight Stability at Sea Symposium. We learned a lot during the first round of classes and intend to continue this outreach program on a recurring basis throughout the Northeast. And if anyone is interested in scheduling a class, please see me, or you can also contact your local commercial fishing vessel safety examiner. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my report. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Any questions for Pete? It's too bad. I had the pleasure of meeting Chief of Staff Joe Servideo. I was going to tell him I'd like him to come to every meeting because when he does, I notice you show up in a pressed, clean suit or uniform. But he's not here.
Yeah, unfortunately, he had to... had another meeting he had to attend. He is possibly the busiest man on the planet, and synchronizing all the Coast Guard operations for the entire northeastern U.S. So I was grateful for his presence today, and it underscores his commitment to the council process. And unfortunately, his schedule is just jam packed. So
great, good. Thanks, Pete.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on. NIMS Enforcement, VMS.
Good morning.
Andy Cohen from the Office of Law Enforcement. I'm here with Bill Semro, the VMS manager. I want to start off by welcoming Pete, and I'm sure that we're going to continue a fine partnership. We can't do it without you, and we really enjoyed working with Joe McGinnis. His leadership got us through a lot of situations, and look forward to the future.
As do I. We can't do it without you either, so thank you.
Yesterday in U.S. District Court in Boston, there was an initial appearance of a defendant who was charged with false labeling in a felony Lacey Act case. This involves the unlawful importation of farmed catfish from Vietnam, and I think I've briefed you on other aspects of this case over the past couple of years. This is an independent case, same scam. I think it's a very important case because, as I've said before, every pound of mislabeled fish that's sold in the United States undermines our domestic industry. Aside from the health problems and consumer fraud, so I will brief you on the progress of that as a trial date nears. This week we had what we called a pulse operation here in Rhode Island in Jamestown, along with the Coast Guard, in which pretty much every boat that that landed was boarded. As of last night, I'm happy to say we detected no violations. Compliance was very good. In future council meetings, I will be joined by one of our enforcement attorneys, Mitch McDonald. Over the years, you folks have posed a lot of questions to me that really were outside the realm of law enforcement. It was more on the other side of the house, how people are charged, why people are charged, and penalties. And Mitch will be able to address those more accurately and, more importantly, more appropriately than I have been able to do. We had a guilty plea of a fellow named Robert Eldridge in U.S. District Court, also in Boston, of three misdemeanor violations of the Endangered Species Act and Marine Mammal Protection Act. Mr. Eldridge is a fisher who entangled a whale and did not use the proper protocol in freeing it. We do not know the fate of the whale in that instance. In the last couple of months, we have charged 48 counts of herring-related violations in three separate cases, a total of 48 counts, all of which involved either permitting issues or non-reporting or misreporting issues. And reporting issues will continue to be a priority for us in our enforcement activities. We had a number of observer issues in this reporting period. There were eight refusals, two of which have resulted in prosecution. We had four observer harassment instances. So far, one of those has been forwarded, and the others have been closed. We had two observer interference complaints. One of those will be forwarded for prosecution. We had 11 safety investigations involving observers, and so far none of those have resulted in a prosecution. That concludes my portion of the report. I can either take questions now or after the VMS segment.
Terry, then Mary Beth.
Yeah, thank you for your report, Andy. Do you know if any of the herring violations that you had were the cases were worked out collaboratively with Maine Marine Patrol? Because after reading this morning, I emailed them to ask about it. I haven't heard back, so.
I don't know definitively. I know that our agents in Maine are working very closely with Maine Marine Patrol, but I can find out for you.
Yeah, I'd really appreciate it if you could follow through, because we've been trying to, you know, particularly as we went through this week, ensure that we have 100% compliance with our monitoring. And every time we can plug a hole like this, it's really helpful. And the other comment I have is, it seems like about every other time you make a report, there's a growing list of violations with the observers in the observer program. And, you know, I hope that your investigations and will follow through with some violations that will be very strictly follow through with. I mean, the monitoring is a whole direction that we're headed in, and you know, without vigilance from you folks, you know, the credibility of our monitoring program is somewhat jeopardized. So I appreciate your help.
Regarding the observer cases, what we're looking for is compliance. We're really not looking to make cases, but of course we do prosecute when it's when it is appropriate. If I won't go over the details, but if you look in the enforcement report, it gives a breakdown of how many of those cases were closed using methods other than filing a violation notice, you know, public outreach or education or a warning or another kind of resolution. The observers have a tough job. We recognize that, and the observer program recognizes that because they give us some funding for enforcement, which we desperately need and utilize. Again, I said this before. We now have a separate section in my enforcement report about observers. I don't think that you can construe that to mean that there's been a great increase in observer issues. We're just breaking it out and reporting on it separately because I think it's of interest to the group.
Well, absolutely. With the dependence that we're going to have on accurate monitoring over the next couple of years, observer compliance, it shouldn't be officer-friendly for much longer.
Mary Beth?
Thank you. You know, one of the things the council's been working on pretty closely is you know, in relationship to herring, is monitoring and reporting. And when you say you have 48 counts for herring, it does just sort of raise some concerns. And I'm just wondering, I mean, it seemed to me the last issue that was raised was in the Mid-Atlantic, not in Maine. And I don't know if this is a continuation of that particular issue that you're telling us, or is this something that's totally new? And is there some issue that the council should be considering in the amendment that we're developing that is based around monitoring that could help this particular problem, or just, you know, any information you want to provide?
Well, I can't answer your question specifically because I'm not really that familiar with these individual cases, but I can tell you in general what the council can do to assist us is to continue to develop regulations that are in keeping with the precepts that we hand out occasionally. That is things that let monitoring be easy, transparent, and consistent across fisheries. Those are the real keys to letting us monitor what's going on, and I think that, you know, monitoring by law enforcement is an important component in getting compliance. If you'd like some specifics, I can find out and I'll call you.
And if it would be helpful, if maybe at the next council meeting at the end of January, if you could have a little more of the specifics for the council on that issue. You did bring it up, I think, when we were in Portland as well. I just had a question on the first point you raised on Mr. Eldridge and the whale issue. As you know, I know Mr. Eldridge personally. We live in the same town, and I think it's unfortunate what happened. I understand why what happened. I guess my question would be, are there going to be any steps taken as a result of this case? Did it cause anyone to consider some outreach to the industry as to reminders of the protocols? Was there a letter mailed to permit holders as to, you know, here's what you're supposed to do when this happens? Is that going to happen?
Well, we hadn't considered stepping up our outreach. I can tell you what we do now. There are posters at marinas. We take out ads along with the sanctuary and partly funded by protected resources, telling people what the rules are for marine mammal and endangered species interactions, including the penalties. There was a full-page ad in, I think, On the Water magazine last issue, and we will continue to do that. However, if you feel that our outreach efforts are not good enough, and if you think that there is a misconception out there about what's permitted and what the protocols are, we should talk. I'm unaware of that at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we should explore. I mean, On the Water magazine is one stakeholder group would read that, but you know, perhaps maybe in commercial fish news or some other venue, National Fishermen, I'm not sure. Because quite frankly, I think what Mr. Eldridge did is a common practice. You know, I'll just put it out there. And the circumstances around his particular situation were such that there was a third party on the vessel that brought that practice to light. And I think that's why what happened in terms of prosecution and ultimately his plea. But I think people need to understand that from my perception, it is a common practice what he did. What fishermen will try to free the mammal if it's in their gear. And they should be aware that if they don't follow the proper protocols, this could happen to them. And it's not necessarily the fine that, in his case, that was the big financial hit. It was the lawyer's fees and following it through, and also the mental and anguish on him and his family wondering if he was going to maintain his permits. And, you know, you can imagine where your mind can run to when you're facing something like that, and you're sitting in your bed 3 o'clock in the morning wondering if you're going to be able to keep providing for your family. So I think it is something we should explore.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your candor, and I don't I will not make light of the impact that a criminal case has on an individual. I won't discuss the individual or the case in depth, but I will tell you that there's a little bit more to the story than what you've portrayed. I understand that he's a neighbor of yours. I've never met the man, and I'm not going to disparage him, but there is more to the story. We have very strict guidelines that we use when we prosecute these kind of cases, and the parameters used for a criminal prosecution of an ESA case or a marine mammal case are that the action had to be either intentional, reckless, or otherwise aggravated. If it's a mere accident or something minor or unavoidable, we don't go that route. But I do appreciate your point.
Okay. Anything further, David?
Andy, I'm discouraged by the number of observer issues, but I'm also encouraged by the fact that a number of them have been resolved in ways other than violations, which tells me that we still have a serious education issue with the fishing industry about the role of observers, their duties and responsibilities, and your duties as a fisherman. So kind of following along with what John said, it appears that we need to do some kind of outreach about you know, what are the industry's responsibilities in carrying an observer, and also to the observers as to what their role is and responsibilities. I know I'm working with the observer program on an issue in New Hampshire about e-perbs and inspecting the decals and whatnot, taking the e-perb apart, and it's been resolved. I think we've come up with a successful resolution of that issue, and I know you're involved in training the observers. Your program is as to what is a violation and whatnot. But I kind of similar to what John said. You know, some kind of, as we ramp up our sector programs here, we're going to have many more observers on vessels, so we're going to have many more interactions between observers and fishermen, and not all of those, unfortunately, are going to be good. So I think we need to educate the fishermen. We also need to educate the observers. We need to come up with a protocol that everybody understands as to what, you know, what observers can do when they get on the boat, what they can't do. For fishermen, what is harassment, what isn't harassment? I mean, you know, some people tell an off-color joke and somebody takes offense at it. I'm not prepared to make a judgment call there, and I don't think you really want to be in that position either as to what is harassment in that case. But we all have to work together, so we've got to find some kind of common ground, some kind of a statement that says, you know, this is off limits, this isn't off limits, so that we all understand where we are. I've never had a problem with an observer. I like having observers on the boat, but I know people that are having issues, and they're kind of the, you know, he said, she said type things that must make it very difficult for you as an enforcement agent to determine who's right and who's wrong. So do you have any thoughts on that as to how we could better define roles and responsibilities?
Good question. Yes, I do. Let me preface it by saying that we don't make cases on off-color jokes. Although I, you know, we don't advocate it taking place, but we do pick and choose our issues. I think that when we take enforcement actions, that's part of the education process, because we have a discussion like this. It's in the report. People talk on the docks, and I think in general people know what is permitted and what is not permitted. And we've seen some pretty egregious cases of harassment and intimidation, and we've seen a lot of lesser problems. I think that I can commit that enforcement will continue to take part in the training and the education, but I'd have to put I'd have to put a lot of it back to the observer program. It's their primary responsibility. Remember, we're the cops. We're not the educators, although education is a big component of our program, and I think it needs to continue to be so. And I would also put it back on the industry. The industry talks a lot about self-policing, and I've got some feelings on how well self-policing works and doesn't work. But in a social situation like an observer issue, I think that peer pressure and peer influence is probably the single greatest tool we've got. So I'll do what I can to help facilitate that, but I really think that the responsibility is on the potential violators.
Thank you. I agree. You know, I'm working very hard to try and educate people in my community about acceptable behavior, and my tolerance for acceptable behavior is probably far less than yours. I receive reports from people who used to be observers that I talk to in social situations and tell me things that, quite frankly, I would have never put up with. You know, that I would have turned them over to you, and I would have considered them a violation of the law. I mean, some observers seem to have a high level of tolerance for bad behavior, and perhaps some don't. But I still think we need to come up with some kind of at least a standardized format as to, so that we all know what is acceptable and what isn't. I know it's hard to write it down, but some people aren't getting the message. And you know, I can talk to them, you can violate them, but I'm still not sure that's going to solve the problem. That's what I guess I'm trying to put forward here.
Mary Beth.
Thank you. The Observer Program has a webpage, and on that webpage there are the roles and responsibilities for vessel captains and crew in relationship to observers. And it does not cover all of these issues that you're discussing, but I have sent it out to all of our captains. I recommend that they post it in the wheelhouse. Everybody should be aware of what their roles and responsibilities are, and I think the Observer Program has provided that information, and I recommend it to everyone.
Anyone else for Andy? Bill?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Council members. My name is Bill Semro, Northeast VMS Program Manager in Gloucester. As reported to you at the September meeting, OLE Silver Spring, Maryland, transitioned to a new GIS monitoring system called VTRAC on August 30th. And my goal was to restore some of the key regional processes by September 30th, a month later. The key processes I'm talking about are, number one, trip generation, which allows the Northeast region to pull VMS trip data into their databases for tracking days at sea usage, and also to more accurately assess U.S.-Canada tax. Secondly, the restarting of trip notification emails to owners and operators of vessels. And three, the days at sea balance service to industry to help fishermen more accurately determine their remaining fishing days. Unfortunately, there were delays experienced in restoring the various VMS and days at sea processes, and those delays pushed the completion date out to November 3rd. So we are back up and running. Days at sea reports and balances are once again available from my staff, and we certainly know how important this service is to the fishermen, and we're doing our best to quickly respond to all their requests. I want to also mention that with regard to VTRAC, the monitoring system that we're using nationwide, the state enforcement agencies are not now getting access to VMS data through the VTRAC system. And unlike the restrictions on our previous monitoring system, which is called SmartTrack, the new VTRAC system has no restrictions as to the number of licenses, which means I expect to see a significant increase in the number of authorized users of our monitoring system, that is, more eyes on VMS. That would probably be in the Coast Guard, regional office people, and, of course, I mentioned state enforcement as well. Moving on to VMS software changes on the vessel side, the next VMS software change will be concurrent with the Amendment 16 implementation in May of 2010. Planning is underway between OLE and other divisions in the Northeast, sustainable fisheries, fisheries statistics, to develop the VMS specifications needed to document changes to the declarations and the VMS forms. Some of those changes include, which I know you're well familiar with, the broad stock area declaration, restricted gear area declaration, concurrent use of a scallop and groundfish day at sea when using trawl gear, expansion of the groundfish catch report to include all 12 species by stock area, a new trip start and trip end hail form for sectors, addition of 5 new differential day at sea areas with geofencing, as well as changes to the VTRAC system in order to quickly identify and monitor sector and common pool vessels. In coordination with the Northeast region, I developed a new document to track short and long-term VMS changes by FMP. OLE headquarters will be given periodic updates in order to help them plan in a budgetary sense for the support of future software rollouts. And I have copies of those documents if anybody's interested. In our continuing effort to help the industry understand their VMS requirements, and that's really a big part of what my team does. They engage the industry quite a bit and try to answer their phones and respond to questions to make sure that they understand what the requirements are. I went ahead and updated the VMS question and answer or Q&A reference document, which is available on our webpage. It's about a 13-page document. I have a few here if anybody's interested. In addition to the VMS Q&A, I'd like to remind fishermen of the VMS user instructions that are also available on a webpage, and my staff would be happy to respond to any requests for either or both of these documents. With respect to the IVR system in the region, or interactive voice response system for declaring day at sea trips for those that are not required to use VMS, the system started to experience frequent downtime the past few months. The region finally had to take the system offline for 2 weeks in order for Verizon to reconfigure the telephone lines. As a result, all IVR days at sea calls were taken on OLE's backup IVR line. And that's where we manually enter the sailing or landing information into the IVR database, and then we return each call to the fishermen and give them their sailing or landing confirmation numbers. There have since been, I will say the main IVR system was restored on November 6th. There have been a few instances since then where the system cut off some fishermen calling the system, cut them off prematurely. But the IRM division seems to have resolved that problem. The main IVR line is, for those that want to write it down, is 888-284-4904. And the backup line in OLE is 888-487-9994. And finally, with regard to VMS data requests, interesting that, you know, for some time now I've seen a spike in the number of VMS data requests that come to OLE, and that's a good thing. People are finding the data useful for their efforts, such as in marine spatial planning. I've also gotten requests from the Coast Guard for evaluation of offshore wind farms in Maine, Mass, and Rhode Island, New York, New Jersey offshore LNG facility, and even the testing of a new airborne radar system. Other requests from states such as Rhode Island and Massachusetts, as I mentioned, in their marine spatial planning efforts, and even from the Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary Office. They've requested data to analyze fishing activity within their sanctuary. There is an OLE policy directive, 195. It was signed on September 10th, which covers requests for access to VMS data from the states or Marine Fisheries Commission employees. Essentially, it's a confidentiality agreement that has to be in place between the agency and the state or the commission. Currently, I'll note that the states of Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Virginia do not yet have confidentiality agreements with the agency. And that concludes my comments. Are there any questions?
I think we're all set. Thank you very much. Anybody wish to report on Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission issues? Dr. Pierce.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, since we are behind schedule, I'll just highlight a couple of issues that would be of interest to this commission. This council, ASMSC, met last week here in the same spot, so it's a pleasure to be back here again. The sea hearing section did not establish any quotas for the next fishing year. We decided to wait until the council took action, and indeed the council has taken action. Therefore, the section will respond in kind in some way at its February meeting next year. A number of other herring issues will be discussed by the section, such as how to deal with desire on the part of the New England states to look into the small mesh bottom trawl fishery in the Gulf of Maine, and how to deal with some equity issues relative to allocating the sea herring resource in Area 1A between gear types. So we're doing an analysis there relative to historical landings and impacts on the quota decrease on any possible strategy to deal with those equity issues. I'm the new vice chair of the sea herring section. Obviously, all of the information and motions that were made by ASMFC are in the binder in a summary of our deliberations. The new striped bass assessment, stock assessment, was provided, and as we expected, management continues to be successful with striped bass. We are well over the biomass target for female spawning stock, 148% of the SSB. Fishing mortality rates are still below the target and certainly below the threshold. Overfishing is not occurring. We are not overfished, and things look quite good for the striped bass resource and the recreational commercial fishery that take advantage of that abundance. The Enforcement Committee. Generally, we don't reference here at the New England Council what happened at the Law Enforcement Committee. However, I think it's important to highlight one particular point that was made, and this is on page 13 of the summary of the ASMFC meeting, where Mark Grant from the National Marine Fisheries Service was present, and he gave a report on sector management. He made a very important statement, which is that in the Northeast, sector management, as it is being introduced now, is relatively new. And because it is a relatively new concept that will have a new look come May 1, 2010, law enforcement is continuing to discuss what needs to be done relative to law enforcement applied to sectors. And they, at this particular meeting, discussed potential impacts on enforceability. So at least we know that ASMFC enforcement is focusing on this issue, as well, of course, as the National Marine Fisheries Service, since enforcement of sector rules and regulations will be quite important. Self-enforcing, obviously, from the sector, but monitoring by other enforcement entities will be important. Weak fish. Once upon a time, a long time ago, in a land distant and far away, we used to have weak fish and recreational fishing opportunities in New England, some commercial fishing opportunities. However, status of the stock is dire. I think it's safe to say that weak fish has collapsed. It is depleted. It is 3% of an unfished stock, well below the 20% threshold and 30% target, reference point targets that we have. As a consequence of this horrific situation, caused primarily due to natural mortality increases, and therein is the twist, natural mortality increases. Because of that, primarily, we now find ourselves, and ASMFC acted on this, to dramatically reduce the recreational limits as well as commercial allowances. There was a great deal of discussion regarding the need for a moratorium on the taking of weak fish up and down the coast. Didn't quite go that far, largely because of discard issues. Go with a complete moratorium, and then we have more discards. So that is perhaps the worst news that came out of ASMFC. There were some discussions about lobster. We have a new addendum regarding lobster. I won't get into those details. That's described on page 17. Of interest to this council is the fact that the ASMFC Policy Board has given a charge to the Management and Science Committee of ASMFC to delve deeper, hopefully quite deep, into so-called ecosystem considerations for ASMFC management, and they have been charged to develop a proposal for incorporating ecosystem considerations into our interstate fisheries management process. This council may benefit from some of those discussions and recommendations that might come out of that Management and Science Committee. For dogfish, similarly, as with herring, the ASMFC, the Dogfish Board, decided to wait until the winter meeting before deciding what to do with the dogfish quotas for 2010-2011, and obviously we'll take notice of what this council does with those specifications today. And then finally, George LaPointe stepped down as chair of ASMFC after a very successful term. He's now been replaced by Robert Boyle from South Carolina. And then after Robert Boyle finishes his stint as chair of ASMFC, then my boss, Paul Diodati, will take over. He will be chair of ASMFC. Coincidentally enough, he'll take over the reins when ASMFC meets in Boston in a few years. So it'll be a fun fest in Boston when that happens. Of great significance, I think, of great importance, and most council members here today would appreciate this because you were here when John Nelson was with us as a member of this council. John Nelson, who I've known and loved for many years, great respect for John and his sense of humor, among other things. Posthumously, he received the Captain David H. Hart Award, and I'll highlight one aspect of that award and a statement that was made about John. Mr. Nelson devoted his career to the promotion of fisheries management and was highly dedicated to his work with the Commission. His wisdom, sound judgment, and exceptional ability to work constructively with others earned him the deep respect of his fellow commissioners. His actions throughout his career exemplified the values and principles reflected in the Hart Award. So that was an award well-deserved for a man who served this council for many years and did such a wonderful job representing the state of New Hampshire.
Questions for Dave? Terry?
Not a question. Good report, Dave. Just a couple more minor issues. One of interest to the council here. The herring section did approve a prohibition of landing of herring in Area 1A until June 1st of next year. And the lobster issue that David referred to was a new limited access for federal permits scenario in Area 1.
Doug?
Yeah, just my one follow-up on striped bass, although the stock, our stock assessment report said that we're not overfishing. Overfishing isn't occurring still, which is very good. There's a lot of concern because there's been a drop in recruitment in the Chesapeake Bay for the past 5 years, and so we're keeping a close eye on that and seeing if we have to respond in future years. Yes, there's also a high incidence. A lot of research has been done on mycobacteria and possibly affecting survival of striped bass in Chesapeake Bay.
Paul Howard.
Dave, I'm sure the commission is aware of the ACL and AM requirements at Magnuson, and the commission can probably learn from the council and the Mid-Atlantic Council about how to implement and develop them. Is there any talk at the policy level of implementing ACLs and AMs in state fisheries?
Yes, there has been some talk regarding that, and as a matter of fact, I believe the herring section actually had some discussion, and there was a draft document being worked on relative to an incorporation of many of the terms and concepts that this council uses, ACL specifically. I suspect that it will continue to evolve in that direction. Much of it may depend upon, I guess, the wisdom of council decisions relative to some of these key species that we manage with the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, with a hope for complementary way.
Chairman Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is certainly an important question for us in the Mid, where we have five species that are subject to joint management with the commission. And we have invited the leadership of each of those commission boards to join us on December the 9th as we develop the AM packages to go with our FMPs. So we are trying to reach out on an ongoing basis to the commission and its leadership on this issue, because in the end we're going to have collaborative management in order to be successful. So we recognize the challenges inherent in that. And that we're operating under different legal standards, but we're continuing to try to address this question on a collaborative basis.
Yeah, just to follow up to David's answer, Paul, there was a specific conversation about ACLs and AMs at the policy board. Staff's putting together a white paper that they're going to come back to the policy board at the winter meeting.
Okay, I think that concludes the very longest priorities discussion or reports discussion I've ever chaired, 2.5 hours. In the interest of time, the next agenda item is review of EFP applications. Unless there's objection there.